Welcome to Offline, a podcast about building a 100% online and remote expertise-driven business without the bullshit. Hosted remotely by me, Liston Witherell.
And me, Philip Morgan. You'll learn how we're building our businesses, what scares the shit out of us, and hear from our friends and experts who are building their remote businesses too. Welcome to Offline.
Philip Morgan.
Liston Witherell.
Welcome to another episode of Offline, my friend.
Thank you. It's nice to be here, to be in the live studio audience for the recording of this podcast.
I know, via computer screen. Do you think it would be all right if we got maybe a laugh track or something like that? Would that enhance things for us?
Have we gotten that feedback that that's something we need?
No.
Really, I thought that was my role here, was to be your laugh track.
Oh, well, that's very nice of you. That my jokes are so bad that people need to be prompted to laugh at them. Thanks, Philip. All right. Today, we are talking about how to develop a point of view. And so, this is something that I don't think I intended to write very much about. It's not specifically sales related in any case, but I wrote about developing authority, and authority being separate from expertise. So you may be an expert in something, but whether or not other people see you as an authority on that topic is not necessarily correlated to your level of expertise.
Right.
So then the question became, well, how do I develop authority? And I thought about that question a lot, and I said, well, I think there are really four things you need. You need to decide on who it's for, aka a market. You have to have a point of view or sort of an approach or philosophy that's underpinning everything you write in your message, everything you say. Then you have to distribute it. So is it going to be a podcast? Is it going to be articles? Is it going to be speaking gigs? And then you need to give it time. And maybe we could have added luck, but certainly the better your point of view, the more targeted, the better your distribution, and the more time you allow, the more lucky you're likely to be. But then, after all of that, the number one question I kept getting was, okay, great, how do I develop a point of view? Which I read Arnold Schwarzenegger's book about bodybuilding.
Okay.
He wrote it in the 70s after he won the Olympia title a bunch of times. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, I didn't expect it, but one of the main things people asked after I wrote the book was how they should breathe while they lift weights. And he's like, I just thought they would know how to breathe already. And so in his subsequent book, he gave specific suggestions on how to breathe. And with point of view, I felt that way a little bit. Like, that's not what I expected. I expected people to ask about choosing a market or which distribution channels to use. And so I got to thinking about this question, how do you develop a point of view? And it turns out,
Liston, you were born with about 30 points of view, probably. That's why you don't perceive this need for understanding how to do it, right? Were you always opinionated?
Yes. It can be a curse.
Okay. I was right. Yep. And I'm a little bit more from the other side of things where my natural sort of response is like, well, I can see that both ways. And you've like several times on this podcast said, oh, come on, pick a stand and stand up for it. I think it's going to be great to hear from us both on this question. Because it is a real question. It's like, it's natural for you, but it's not natural for everybody.
Okay. So yeah, it's natural for me.
And that's my point of view, Liston.
And I'm not disputing your point of view. You can have your own point of view. It reminds me of Seinfeld had this joke about think tanks. And then of course it descends into like, oh, I think blah, blah, blah. And then he's like, I don't like the way you think. I do think I am naturally opinionated. I agree with that. I also spend a lot of time learning, and I think that greatly informs and deepens the points of view that I do have. So I don't know. I guess you can determine by the end of this, dear listener, whether or not it just comes naturally to me or if I'm actually proactively doing things to influence my point of view and the strength of it.
Well, that's just like your point of view, man.
Right. I know. There's no end to this argument, right?
So what differentiates a point of view from an opinion? That was my hopefully inside joke to fans of the dude. What differentiates an opinion from a point of view?
I don't know the answer to that. Do you have one?
I would say a point of view can be substantiated in some way. It can be argued. It can be supported. And an opinion doesn't necessarily rise to that level of supportability.
Huh. I don't know. I think it could be semantic. Why is it important to draw a distinction between a point of view and an opinion?
Pushing back against one of the objections, it's like, well, why should you be opinionated? Why shouldn't you just be like, tell us what to do, dear client, and we shall do it according to your specifications. We are neutral on all questions of decision-making and implementation. We're just here to serve you. That is, I can't say for sure a piece of pushback I've gotten precisely on that, but it is an objection to the idea that a point of view is valuable.
Yeah.
Doesn't the client always know best?
No.
What if your point of view differs from your client's point of view?
Yeah.
I know I'm muddying the waters here, but I am kind of trying to make a case for why this matters by throwing you under the bus, Liston. That's what I'm doing here.
My opinion is that it doesn't matter very much, but I think the key idea here is you have to have, in my writing, I've gone away from the term point of view because I think it's so muddy.
Okay.
Whereas worldview seems to be a little bit stronger in that it's a way that you see the world and it's an explanation you choose for why things are the way they are.
Wow. That's a big level up, like in an impressive good way from point of view. It's like, because to me, a point of view could be a very limited opinion on a certain thing that you can substantiate. You're kind of encouraging us to go big or go home, like to turn this point of view into a worldview.
I am. I think it's important to do that. And I think maybe counterintuitively, it's a lot easier to use it as a guiding force if you're looking at it as sort of a, almost like a natural law, right? Like sort of like a law of physics. And now, again, I don't want to get into a semantic discussion here, but for instance, I'll give you an example of it. I was having a discussion with a guy about SEO today, and he was talking about the future of search. And I said, it's my very unpopular opinion that the internet over time will not be a democratizing force. It will be a force that strengthens only the biggest companies and everybody else will be basically trampled. And I can give you all sorts of reasons for that. But like that would be an example of a worldview where I'm sort of looking at it as there's sort of an inevitable conclusion to this based on the way I see things.
I like that you're going big here. And I will resist my hardwired tendency to turn this into a semantic discussion.
Damn you, Philip.
Damn me. Please proceed.
So the first thing I wanted to answer is essentially, how do we define this? So we've already tried maybe in a feeble attempt to do that, but I would put forward a three-part test, which I think is pretty easy, or maybe not a test, but like a way that you can gauge how strong is the worldview that you've set out. And so number one, it's counterintuitive, or few other people would say it. Now, if it's counterintuitive, it's going to be more memorable and stronger, I think. Number two, it explains a trend others agree exists. Number three, it's simple and memorable.
Does it need a label? Is that part of the memorability part?
How so?
Well, let's talk about Ben Thompson, who writes Stratechery, and his aggregation theory, which is for sure, I think, a point of view or a worldview or somewhere in between. I'm not sure he would use those terms to describe it, but let's just go with that. That has a really nice handle, like a label for it. Two words, memorable. There's not a lot of namespace pollution there. So I don't think anybody else has tried to coin that term. I know Jonathan Stark is pretty good at coining terms for things. That seems to be helpful. Maybe that's not part of the litmus test here, but having a nice, memorable label for it, I think sure helps.
I do think it helps. So like for me, in my business, I would say serve, don't sell is my worldview on how sales should be.
Yeah.
And so that is a simple way to summarize something that I believe, which other people would probably agree with and some people would disagree with, which is a good thing.
Do you think it's okay to have a limited worldview, meaning this worldview only really applies in the following situation?
Totally, because I don't think there's any one piece of advice that applies in every situation, unless it's like truly a natural force like gravity,
right? Yeah, yeah, a true natural law, yeah.
Yeah, otherwise it's laws of thermodynamics. Otherwise, I don't think that you'd be so severely limited in the way you can explain things. Okay. But human behavior has lots of different motivations. People behave in lots of different ways, often counterintuitive ways, often in contradictory ways. So I think there's lots of explanations that could be had.
So for our audience's benefit, they should know that your worldview doesn't have to explain absolutely everything. It can be limited to my worldview on design typography or my worldview on sales in an online setting.
Well, for you, it's going to be your worldview of the best way for a coder to become a consultant, right? Or for any freelancer or self-employed person to go more into a consulting or a coaching advisory type business. You're going to have a prescriptive way that you tell people to do that, and it's underpinned by what you see is the most effective way to do it, which is your worldview.
So why do you feel like one of the things that must have is this counterintuitive quality, it being your worldview or your point of view?
I don't think it must have that.
Okay. That's a nice to have?
Yeah. I think these are the three are nice to have. It's like if you had all three, it's going to be a much stronger worldview that you can put in front of people. But I don't think it needs to be counterintuitive. I think it's certainly more memorable. So example would be Simon Sinek's Start With Why. I don't think it's totally counterintuitive if you know anything about marketing, but for a lot of people, they start with how is the way they typically would approach it, or start with what is it, is the way they would typically approach marketing a product or a service. And so that was, I'd say, fairly strong.
Yeah, your point of view really is not separate from the context that it's in. The Start With Why message, if that was to an audience of people who are in mission-driven businesses, they'd be like, duh, who got this guy on stage? Like, we figured this out 100 years ago. But a different audience is going to find that point of view meeting all of your criteria. It's simple and memorable. It explains a trend that, yes, wow, that is why Apple's doing so well. And it's counterintuitive.
Yep.
But in a different context, who would fail on all three of those tests? Well, two out of the three.
Right. Which I think is a nice segue to the first thing that you went to, which was about generating a point of view that your clients care about and how that's kind of the necessary condition if you're doing this for business reasons.
Yeah, for sure. I wonder if I'm actually, no, I was just having a moment of questioning there. Am I just being unnecessarily explicit when I call this out? But then I remember all the things in my 20s and 30s that I thought were important that no client cared a rat's ass about. And some of my clients, when I'm asking them, like, do you have a unique perspective on your work? Or is there some way that you do things that you think is really integral to producing good results? And sometimes they tell me something that qualifies as a point of view, and sometimes they don't. And I've been there, so I say this, I hope, with a fair amount of empathy. But yeah, when I think about cultivating a point of view, and I use that word because it feels like a more biological process than a mechanical process. It doesn't feel like follow these three steps and you will have an amazing point of view. It doesn't feel so mechanistic. It feels sort of alchemical or biological in its nature. So I say you cultivate a point of view, and it needs to be something your clients care about. Your views on politics or development within the Bay Area are probably not relevant to your clients if you're some sort of technical consultant. And so I have a lengthy list. I'm not sure we should go through every item on my list, Liston, but perhaps it could go in the show notes or something like that. It's a long list of ways to think about this question from your client's perspective. So like my first one is, what causes or increases uncertainty for your clients? Boy, is that a wide open-ended question. But if you start thinking about that and you're trying to look at things from your client's perspective, what causes uncertainty for them or increases that? Hopefully you've got a list of things, right? And those are all candidates for you to start thinking about. And out of that thinking may come a point of view, an opinion that you could substantiate in some way. So anyway, I don't know if we're going to go through my whole list or not. It might be a little tedious.
On that note, that made me think of something which is not on my list. So I have a list I've been writing about methods that might help you start to create or identify your point of view. But what you just said is something that I should have had sort of unifying everything on my list. That's, I think, an important point. So on this note of risk or uncertainty, if you go out and make the list and you're gathering what's valuable to my client, where do they see the risks in their business? What are some common problems that they might have and why? I think the really important thing here is you need to be able to abstract what is the common thread here. That's really where the point of view comes from, is you're looking for patterns in the information that you're observing that's relevant to your clients and relevant to their current situation. And I think that pattern identification part of it is just absolutely crucial.
I agree. I mean, you see this in when you look at pretty much any worldview. I mean, let's have a little fun and take the worldview of the typical conspiracy theorist.
Yes.
Their worldview is that shadowy forces are arrayed against me or people like me, and they are orchestrating hidden levers to harm us or get one over on us or what have you, right? So in the mind of the person who holds that worldview, that pattern is real. It exists. So let's just say it's real, even though we might disagree. So that pattern explains so many things to them. It's the sort of wild card pattern of like, well, I don't understand why that happened. So boom, insert my explanation. And like a really amazing, now shifting to like a good point of view, one that's actually functional in explaining things. That's one of the things that makes it so appealing, is it seems to explain things to people. That's what makes Ben Thompson's aggregation theory really compelling, is that it explains why Facebook is dominant, why Google, why Netflix is dominant, why Spotify is dominant within music streaming. It explains why these companies have achieved dominance. And so to your point, what you just said, listen, it's really nice if a point of view has that power to explain things. Starting with that goal in mind can be maddening, though, because I don't know anybody who started with that goal in mind and just gotten there in one step. It's a lot of steps to get there, I think.
Yeah, so it is a lot of steps. And as I said, I think in developing authority, one of the key components that a lot of people don't talk about is time. They're very prescriptive and sort of mechanical. Go out and do these three activities over and over again, and it's definitely going to work. And we don't actually know that to be the case. And I think that developing your point of view, which is a subset of developing your authority, it's a feedback loop, right? As you're trying to develop your authority, you start to crystallize and hone in more specifically on what that point of view is and how it applies in different situations.
Right.
So I have some methods here, but I know you have some questions that you have on your list. I agree. We shouldn't go, I don't think, through your whole list or my whole list, but what are some of the top things you would want people to think about? Because I think these questions are great food for thought.
Like you said, risk and uncertainty are themes that pervade a lot of this list of questions I have.
Yeah.
So one of the questions, I'll just read it. What is the biggest risk to your clients, something that you could do something about at your current level of engaging with clients, or maybe one or two levels of involvement higher in the organization? So don't just think about what you do today, but think about if you gave yourself a promotion and instead of dealing with a director, you were dealing with a VP, or instead of dealing with a VP, you were dealing with a C-level job function, and that was your buyer and your main point of contact. What is the biggest risk your clients face that you could do something about at that range of levels from where you are now to, let's say, the C-level? And identify those risks as best you can and think about, okay, what causes those risks? Is it some lack of data? Is it some lack of worldview that could be applied to that situation to help make better decisions and reduce the risk? And one example, I guess, from the world of investment is sort of modern portfolio theory, that you should distribute investments in a certain way to manage risk. And you would have different risk postures at different, with different goals in mind and different starting points. And maybe there's some way to kind of apply that thinking to your clients and develop this point of view or this worldview that's really relevant to them and helps them reduce risk. And I know there's like, this maybe to some people sounds like draw two circles, now draw the rest of the fucking owl. But that's just because I'm trying to say something that's generally applicable to a range of people, not if I was talking one-on-one with somebody, it could be more specific. That's one of the items that might be a sort of overarching theme on my list of questions. Think about risk and uncertainty. Think about what might make that risk lower or that uncertainty lower, and see where that leads you in terms of ideas for a point of view.
I like this one that you said here on your list. Where specifically do your clients do work that's sloppy, misguided, badly planned, or held back by errors or bugs? How might we deduce a worldview based on that?
Well, as I was hearing you read that back to me, I was thinking about like every sort of freelancer watering hole I've ever been a part of. And there's like a client bitching thread somewhere in there that is like bitching about this stuff, right? Oh, they're such a stupid blah, 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 blah. And then I never see anybody say, you know, I'm going to do something about this and I'm going to educate the sort of client cohort that I work with, not that specific client, but I'm going to create a platform for myself where I change that. I mean, you see some people do that, and it's amazing when it works because these people become sort of thought leaders in a way. So this is starting a little more close to the tactical end of things.
Mm-hmm.
Where specifically do your clients do work that's sloppy, misguided, badly planned, held back by errors or bugs? That's a little more towards the tactical end. So for some folks, that may feel like a safer entry point to this idea of having a point of view. And it could be something simple like we don't ship features that we haven't done a code review on or something like that. I'm sort of making up some of this as I go. I'm not a developer myself. Or in the question of making a decision about how to specialize, it's like, well, you don't do that until you have documented demand for that specialization or something like that. So that might lead you to sort of rules of thumb or best practices, which again would be a bit more tactical, a little less about planning and a little more about how things are done. But for some people, that may be the right place to start dipping their toe in this pool.
Yeah. So I've spent a lot of time thinking about what are some methods? Like, first of all, I will be the first to admit I never sat down and said, you know what? I really need to develop a point of view. Again, maybe this is back to my natural innate tendency to have.
We're born with 30 of them, dude.
Yeah. To have a strong point of view. I don't know. But I never thought that, right? So I've been thinking, first of all, if I wanted to sit down and do that, how would I go about it?
Right.
And it all starts with learning about whatever the space is that I'm interested in or the subject, right?
Yeah.
Question, of course, is, okay, what methods could you use to learn about the thing? And one of them that's really stands out to me is to look to other fields. So I'll give you an example. I was looking at, when I think about a point of view, I started to think about, well, what are some professional practices that reflect a reformed point of view or altering or updating a point of view? And I think the practice of innovation is really close to your point of view, right? So like Nike, how did Nike form? They were like, there aren't any good running shoes available. We're going to make good running shoes, which like was not really a popular or like something a lot of people thought about. They just sort of take for granted, like you run in what we have.
Yeah.
And they're like, no, we could do much better than that. And if you look to other fields at the way they solve problems, or look outside of your own field and try to look for analogs, that can be a way to start to develop your own point of view. So I looked at this example by Harvard Business Review, and they did a study where they were trying to improve a painter's mask. And so they asked contractors to give some ideas on how to innovate on the painter's mask. And then they asked roofers to give some ideas. And the roofers had much more innovative ideas than the contractors, but only marginally so. And then they asked skaters, professional skateboarders,
yeah,
to innovate on the painter's mask. And they had the most innovative ideas of the three groups. which I thought was just an interesting example, right?
It makes me wonder how the innovation was measured, but that's a conversation for another time, I'm sure.
Of course it would, Philip.
Yes. Let's assume that it was a valid measurement, a useful measurement, in other words.
Well, I think the key is if you're looking at other industries, you're going to have ideas introduced that aren't the conventional wisdom in whatever industry or practice you're in. And I think there's a lot of value in that.
I do too. And I'm concerned that the sort of perennial objection to effective specialization will come up here and folks will say, aha, you deprive yourself of that like oxygen supply of outside ideas and creativity and innovation when you specialize. And I'm like, no, specialization doesn't mean you become a monk.
Right. You shut off the possibility of learning anything new outside of your specialization.
Exactly. It doesn't mean that at all. I feel compelled, weirdly compelled, to just point out that there's this idea of the T-shape expert. It's been around, I think, IBM or McKinsey were maybe some of the first to start talking about this publicly, that they wanted these people who had a really deep expertise in some area, that's the vertical stroke of a capital letter T, but it was combined with a sort of broad awareness of other fields and disciplines and, you know, like a worldliness. And I just don't know any experts who aren't naturally like that. It just doesn't seem like something you have to really try that hard to do. So anyway, to those who are like, aha, Philip, we have you, I say not so fast.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, yeah, the advice isn't go away from your expertise. The advice is continue to be learn and be interested in other areas, right? So today I wrote an email about sales that was in reference to a sitcom I was watching with my wife. Not that sitcoms are the most fertile ground for developing your expertise. I'm not saying that either. What I am saying is if you pay attention, there's all of these opportunities to look for and apply ideas that otherwise wouldn't have been obvious.
Yeah. And I do agree that that can really help, but yeah, whatever point of view you cultivate, it can help it be more kind of fresh feeling if it's not just totally dripping in the terminology and the sort of well-established ideas of your area of focus. So you're kind of importing exotic spices, if you will, from elsewhere.
Right. So another one that I wanted to point out, and this has surfaced in a lot of the things that you were saying, is building a data set.
Yeah.
So you and I both have a lot of respect for David C. Baker, and it seems like building his data set has not only been a defensible barrier to competition in his business, but it has also informed and hardened his point of view, because as he grows that data set, he's now can look at trends, longitudinal trends, 20-year trends. He can, I think it's funny, I've heard him say this on other podcasts, and when I interviewed him too, he said, I almost feel like my advice was juvenile just like 3 years ago. Like, I can't even believe I said some of that stuff to my clients, because I'm always evolving what I learn and what I know. And he didn't say this specifically, but I'm guessing the data set that he's built is a big part of it.
Yeah. I mean, you'll hear David talking about himself sort of more as a scientist who happens to consult than a consultant who happens to collect data. I'm not speaking for him here. My observation is that data plays a really central role in formulating his points of view on various things. And that's a very strong place to be coming from, because you can say, well, that's not just my opinion, man. There's data that supports this. One of the things that I think is a wonderful shortcut to cultivating a point of view is to collect some data that matters to your clients. And what makes it matter? See my earlier comments about it lowers risk, it reduces uncertainty. Those are kind of vague ways of saying that it matters. But if you think about that, your specific clients from that perspective, where do they have uncertainty? Where do they face risk? And you collected some data that would improve those situations. You have, I believe, a very powerful tool, and it's very likely to lead you to some point of view. And the point of view is going to go something like this. Well, the data I've collected says fill in the blank. Sometimes it's just, I think it's just so simple. Sometimes that data is just out there and just someone needs to collect it, which is thankless work that is risky for you because you're not sure what that data is going to show or prove. But there's no profit without risk, as who said that?
Peter Drucker.
Peter Drucker, thank you. Or all profit comes from risk taking or something of that nature. And this is can be a very profitable form of risk taking. It's like, hey, let's collect some data that answers a question our clients have. And it can get more intensive, like, and harder to do and more costly, like surveying people or interviewing people or measuring things out in the world. But they're just so simple. I don't understand why more people don't do it. It's just it's a very entrepreneurial thing to do, to collect some kind of data set or build a data set. And sometimes it's just so easy. You could do it over with a few weekends and some help from folks on Fiverr or just all by yourself. You could collect a meaningful data set if it's driven by the questions your clients actually are trying to answer.
I agree with that. And I think that the building the data set really depends, the ease of doing it, and also even if you can build a data set in the first place, really depends on the type of consulting you do.
Sure.
But I do think it's powerful because if your point of view is based on the data set, to your point of substantiation or being able to quote prove your point of view or worldview, the data set is your backstop to it, which is amazing.
Yeah. Now, I'm not trying to say that it's easy. It is simple, but it's not always easy to do this. The data set has the greatest value when it stays consistent over time. So you can do what you talked about earlier, Liston, and derive these sort of longitudinal insights from it. Like, oh, I can see from my data that 5 years ago, X was happening, and now this is happening. And that means we need to do this other thing. It's very powerful to be able to say that. Decision makers love being able to hear someone make a case for why they should do X versus Y. But it's hard to build a data set and keep it consistent over time. That adds difficulty.
Yeah, that adds quite a bit of difficulty.
Because if you're a sort of a maturing consultant, your perspective on the problem or your formulation of the question early on might be inadequate compared to what you can do later, which means you might start asking the wrong questions for your data set.
Well, not only that, I think the authenticity of the data is a consideration. So for me, like, it would be great to go out and build a data set about how people sell. And it could just be like, what was your pipeline last year? How many deals did you close? And I could contrast high growth firms with low growth firms and the types of channels that they use and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Of course, a lot of it would be self-reported. Whereas, like, I don't know what's in David's data set. I'm guessing it's a lot of financial information. And of course, everybody keeps their books. So that's probably an easier data set to collect. Again, I don't know. Isn't it also a 25 question survey?
I don't know a lot of specifics there. I just know that his general approach is he's going for objectivity.
Right.
So he's trying to not fall into the very common traps that you would fall in with self-reported data. And he's tried, like, it includes a personality assessment.
Mm.
And he's tried different ones to try to find the ones that are most scientifically valid. So basically I'm saying, I don't know exactly what's there, but I know he's put a lot of thought into it.
Sure. Yeah.
Before we move on, I wanted to throw in one more thing, which is the purpose of this data set that might underlie your point of view or your worldview is not to get into a peer-reviewed journal. I'm quoting almost directly from Douglas Hubbard here, who wrote a book, How to Measure Anything.
Great book.
Which I think is a very important book in the context of this conversation. The purpose of this data set is to reduce uncertainty, or the purpose of measuring most things in a business context is to reduce uncertainty. If you're working on something for SpaceX, okay. Your data has a different purpose.
Yeah, it's to prevent death.
Even worse things.
Right.
But that's not most of us. Most of us are trying to help clients make better decisions, and reducing uncertainty, not eliminating it, reducing it is our goal. And just doing that adds tremendous value.
Well, and understanding that even if you do work for SpaceX, there's no way to eliminate uncertainty or risk, right? There's absolutely It's not possible. Yes, I agree. So I think generally speaking, some data is better than no data, even if it is self-reported, as long as that's a disclaimer. I think that there can be findings in there that can be valuable still.
Yeah.
So related to that, instead of collecting your own data set, there's another way to go about this, which is how academia typically does research, which is literature reviews or reviewing secondary data. So if someone went out there and did primary research, and you can aggregate some of that together and potentially have new findings or new insight that you didn't have before that's valuable to clients.
Yep. And what I love about this is sometimes it can be done with you all by your lonesome in front of your computer. You don't have to interview people. You don't have to ask people to fill out a survey. You don't have to do any of that stuff. You just have to look at what's already there with a specific question that you're trying to answer or a set of questions that you're trying to answer. So I love the idea that just kind of looking at the data or knowledge assets that other people have created through a particular lens can produce something meaningful. Because I'm always like, okay, where's the side door here? I know what the front door looks like. And in a lot of cases, the front door is difficult and expensive. So where's the side door we can go in through?
Yeah. And that seems to me like kind of the lowest barrier way to just get started and like go learn something that you don't know. So when I record my solo podcast, I always do some of that, right? I'm going to talk about topic X, already have an opinion on it. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe this is it. I want to form a point of view. So back to your initial thing, right? In other words, I think I have kind of a gut feeling about this. I want to go, maybe not do an exhaustive literature review, but go find 3 to 5 sources that I trust that I think would have some information that's a little bit more data-driven or rigorous than just sort of what feels natural to me.
You want to go out and cherry pick the data that supports your point of view.
Obviously. Isn't that what every good scientist does?
Yeah, I think so. That's it right there in the definition. And I jokingly bring that up to kind of illustrate a point that you certainly can take this too far and start with your point of view and then, you know, try to backfill it with something that supports it. Or you can be a little more open-minded and say, well, I'm going to do some research and see if this enriches my point of view or contradicts it or what have you. And I'm sure you're coming from that more open-minded perspective.
Okay. So this can be slightly semantic, right? I guess the practice is different, but if you approach the question and you say, okay, I want to learn, for me, it's like, I want to have an opinion or a worldview about like how to approach sales and should I be more giving and sort of ask more questions or should I be really prescriptive?
Okay.
So then I was like, well, what does the data say about how much people talk in the process? Like, do you do better or worse if you talk a lot, right? And so in that way, I already had an opinion on it, but I wanted to see what does the data bear out and sort of I'm looking for the counter too, right? There are definitely people out there who talk a lot and do really well in sales. What's the difference?
Yeah.
And so being able, I think maybe one thing that I would just add to what you're saying is definitely don't just go out and look for things that support your opinion. Also look for things that are directly contradictory to the thing that you want to prove so you can understand why, right?
That's also a sign of health or vitality for a point of view is if it's something that someone could disagree with. I am by no means the first person to point this out, but it's pretty well established that we would maybe call that a polarizing point of view, right? Mm-hmm. Your first item on your litmus test, it's counterintuitive, or a few other people would say it. That gets at sort of the same thing, which is, this is something that reasonable people can disagree about. I think that has real value. I think because it either gets your buyer on the same side of the table with you or lets them know that there's probably a deal breaker here and we should just not do business together.
Yep, I totally agree.
I mean, how good would you feel if you had some sort of life-threatening illness, you go to a specialist, or you go to a bunch of specialists, and they all say the same thing. There's like, well, there's 4 treatments for this, and I don't know, just pick one, man. You know, there's 6 treatments here. Here's a 6-sided die. Just roll that, and we'll go with whichever one comes up. How would that feel to you? You want something that tells you this person is thoughtful, they've thought about it, and I'm either going to trust them because I think they're more thoughtful than me, or I agree with them because we've both thought about this. And they might know some stuff I don't know, but we fundamentally agree. We kind of share the same worldview. Or I'm out of here because we disagree. Like, you want to be, I think, in one of those three places. You do not want an expert who's like, well, we could do it this way or that way or that way. And why don't you choose and let me know what you decided on?
Yeah, exactly. I agree. And I think, yeah, you need to take a position and basically have a fucking point of view, right? So if it's your doctor, maybe the point of view is, look, whatever your malady is, there's not a lot of risk here. Let's just go with the least risky option because there's no point in taking on any additional chance of harm.
Yeah.
Like whatever it is, they should be able to explain to you how they would approach the decision themselves and why.
Yeah. I hate acknowledging anything good about Gary Vee. But I will say he does a really great job of having a point of view. And it's one that kind of like when it occasionally lines up with how I see things, it almost makes you go like, fuck yeah, man.
Totally.
When he like calls people out for wanting to take the easy route and not put in the work. Like that's one that does kind of sort of line up because I think the easy route is usually some kind of cop out or some sort of compromise that I would find unacceptable. It's not like I want to make things harder than they have to be, but sometimes you just have to do the work.
Right.
And so when you see this guy look someone in the eye with a microphone and just call them whatever he calls them, you're kind of like, fuck yeah. And that's that polarizing aspect to it.
Right. Yeah. Gary Vee is a great example of worldview. What is it? Eat shit. Isn't that what he says? You have to eat shit for a few years.
I don't follow him enough to be able to describe his entire worldview, but I have seen a few videos where that's clearly the point of view that he's expressing is like, you're making a compromise that's going to kill this thing. And the reason you're doing it is because you don't want to put in some work and you need to just put in the work. Well, that'll sort of be the nice version of his message.
Well, I'd say his message is anyone and everyone can succeed if they work hard enough. Right. And the thing that's holding you back, if you're not as successful as you want to be, is that you're not working hard enough.
Which I think is a simplistic view of the world. But maybe that's another
of course it is.
True thing about points of view is that they are somewhat intentionally simplified so that they become memorable.
Well, to a degree, any model needs to be reductionist, right? That's what a model is by definition. It can't cover
yeah, true.
All situations.
Yeah, true.
So I think it does need that element of it. And like you said, for the audience, when they hear it, they go, oh yeah, yes, I agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think like Gary Vee, right? He happened to come in a time when everybody's looking for the easy way out. I remember there was this book by this guy who has a company called Contently. I don't know how to say it. Shane Snow. And it's called Smart Cuts, which is like yet another book about like growth hacking and this whole growth hacking movement. And one thing that I'll say about Gary Vee is he said what I was thinking about all of these growth hacking things is like, essentially, it's a diet pill. It's an attractive idea because people are like, oh, I could get there and with only 5% of the work. And of course, that's not the story either.
Yeah.
How many things did Dropbox try before they found the growth hack to get viral signups, which by the way, didn't lead them to profitability either. So all that stuff's left out of the story.
Yeah.
So I think timing and luck is an aspect of this, but anyway, I think we've gone on enough, Philip. What we're going to do also, dear listeners, if you're interested still in more methods to help you find your worldview or all of Philip's questions, is you can just look in the show notes. They're right there for you.
I like that.
Did we miss anything, Philip?
I could talk about this for hours and hours more. I am unconvinced that that would be interesting to our audience. So I think we've reached the stopping point where we've covered a few of the critical, interesting facets of this. And to me, it's just so interesting because it's so interwoven with expertise, economically valuable expertise. So there's a lot to talk about, but I think we've done it justice for an hour-long conversation.
I think so too. And I think it is so interwoven. And I think it's also such a crucial underpinning to all of your sales and all of your marketing that you will ever do. If you nail this, it will basically act as gasoline on the fire. And if you don't, it's going to be one of these things where you're having to spend a bunch of your time marketing with very little progress. So it will put that sheen on whatever you're doing that maybe isn't there now or isn't obvious.
Shiny.
Indeed, my friend. It was good to talk to you.
You too.